a cutthroat kitchen tournament of terror.
Look at my legs!
Chefs fire up some frightening frog legs, brew a wicked witch's stew, and summon a dreadful devil's food cake.
Well, well. Has a new recipe.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and if you've been watching Cutthroat Kitchen on the Food Network, you've met our first guest on KCUR's Central Standard. Janet Ross is the sous chef at Cafe Sebastian, and she's been wielding scary-looking knives on a horror-themed reality show. Hi, Janet.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm just great.
Explain the idea behind Cutthroat Kitchen. We just got a taste of it, but you guys are supposed to make scary food and like sabotage each other?
Well, that is what we do in the Tournament of Terror. However, it's very similar. Every episode is quite similar to what we just did for the Tournament of Terror. You are given $25,000 and everyone has to bid on sabotages to make their opponents and chefs go down so you can ultimately be the last one standing.
Food and terror are not things that I usually put side by side, especially like, you know, chef-prepared food.
Well, I think they came up with some pretty interesting Halloween-themed dishes for us to prepare. But
like lots of organ meats and some frog legs.
So there were some frog legs. I had liver and fava beans in my episode, and so the dishes themselves, you think, well, no problem, but it is a problem if you're wearing claws that are barely sharp enough to cut and totally curved to where you just are ripping at food. So yeah, to come out with a really pretty dish with some of the situations they put you in is pretty difficult.
Does your personality lend itself to that kind of thing? I mean, are you into scary stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I like scary movies. I love Halloween. I always decorate a little bit for Halloween. I loved to trick or treat when I was a kid. I wish it was the same as it was back then, back in the olden days.
But oh man, we're actually going to be talking about that on this show.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, but well, we get a few trick or treaters at our house, and I love to prepare for that.
The competitive aspect of cooking on a reality show is interesting to me. I mean, I think a lot of us outside of kitchens anyway think of the culinary arts as just that, as an art. But are Kansas City's professional kitchens competitive environments? Is there anything cutthroat about them?
I don't think so at all. I think all of our chefs here in town are behind each other 100%, where there's a lot of camaraderie. There's a lot of, just friendships between everyone. So there's no one trying to, you know, of course you want to have your restaurant be the best restaurant and have the best food at any, like, at the events that we have. We do a lot of events here, and we always hope to have some of the best dishes. But no, I don't think there's anything cutthroat about how our chefs in this town treat each other.
You haven't always been a chef. Tell me about your life before you found your calling in food.
Well, you know, let's see. Let's go back when.
Way
back, yeah. I'm kind of a fly-by-the-seat-of-my-pants kind of gal, and I, you know, really didn't know what I was going to do. Like, let's say in high school, everyone kind of has a plan, or college. I wasn't really sure, so it all just kind of fell into place. I was a server at some of Kansas City's finest iconic restaurants for years, about 18 years. Started out at the Prospect of Westport, a wonderful, way ahead of its time restaurant, and then went to the Westport Classic Cup, and then to Venue. And those were my three kind of big restaurants I served. And I watched my chefs very closely at all of those places, and turned out that I was really interested myself and thought, I'm going to give this a shot. So I started my own catering business.
I want to get back to your early food career, but you also did something else, something that even people who have like met you and know you socially, it's like a big surprise.
Oh, are you talking about the cheerleader for the Kansas City Chiefs?
I am.
Yeah, that was earlier, late 70s, early 80s. Yeah, back in the lean years. But I am a huge Chiefs fan and always will be and always have been. And yes, I did do that. And it was great fun.
They called them Chiefettes back then. And you have to forgive me. I don't know if that's still a thing.
Well, yeah, I think they're called Chiefs cheerleaders now. Back in the day, there were two different groups of girls. One was Chiefettes, and then the other groups were Chiefs cheerleaders. I was actually a Chiefs cheerleader.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the Chiefs cheerleaders were the ones out on the field the entire time. The Chiefettes were the ones that came in and did all the dances, like at the pregame or halftime. So, and then they combined the two groups in 1980. So then I think since then it's been just Chiefs cheerleaders.
It seems like it would be such a different world from where you are now.
Being a Chiefs cheerleader?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm still kind of a cheerleader kind of girl anyway.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, if I have any friends or anybody in any kind of situation, I'm right there to cheer them on. I'm loyal to all my good friends.
I know that this is like just a random chapter in your history, and we'll get back to the main food chapter in a second. But I assume there's kind of a gender component to being a cheerleader for football and just playing on a certain idea of femininity. Can you talk about that?
Oh, I didn't know I was going to be asked this question.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's all right. You know, I wasn't the type of cheerleader that, you know, really cared about that. I literally cared about the sport. I cared about the game. I knew about the game. And that always used to upset me a lot with some of the other girls. They didn't even know, like, our quarterback's name, you know, or know about the game itself. So I'd like to think that I was there to literally cheer for the sport and for our guys and on our team. So I wasn't that kind of cheerleader.
Does thinking about professional kitchens, I mean, just thinking about how gender might come into some of the different roles you've had, I mean, professional kitchens, when you especially see like food shows or just the idea of the chef that most people have, it comes across as a male world, though obviously at Cafe Sebastian, where you work right alongside a head chef who is also a woman, that's clearly not the case. Can you talk about gender in the kitchen?
Well, we don't really feel like we have any. There is a kind of a boys show here in town. We do have a lot of, you know, great male chefs. They don't scare us. we work our tails off and we're not afraid. And actually, that's how this whole Cutthroat Kitchen thing came about, is they couldn't find enough female chefs to be on the show. So they contacted Jennifer and I at the restaurant. I think they found us like on the web, maybe through one of our CCVI food fight functions or something, and because they were having a lot of trouble finding female chefs. So that's how I got on the show in the first place. I hadn't even seen the show until we were asked to be on the show. So
you're talking before about how you got interested in food working as a server and then kind of gradually observing what was happening in the kitchen and kind of taking more and more of an interest in that. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about those experiences, about the kitchens you worked in and what it was that was taking you?
I don't know. I enjoyed food so much that I don't know. I just I was very interested in what my chefs were doing. I wanted to do that. I for some reason it just grab me, and it's something I wanted to do because I enjoyed serving the food, so I wanted to make the food. And so just watching closely, getting in the way, literally in the kitchen, one of my ex-chefs will certainly vouch for this. I was always wanting to stir something or, you know, get in there and just be with the food. And so that's how it all kind of came about.
In those different kitchens you mentioned before, when you listed your first couple of restaurants where you had worked, and restaurants that are really memorable for people in Kansas City, mm-hmm. They're not open anymore. Can you compare kind of what you witnessed in those kitchens, like different styles, and maybe I'm thinking about someone informing what's going to be their own approach and watching different people on the job, taking little bits and pieces?
Well, I think a lot has changed. I don't know. I think we just had more fun. I mean, some of the restaurants I worked in, I mean, we were just so busy and just, you know, just, it was just a booming business all the time. And so it was, you really never had a chance to really, you know, think about anything else, but just making the people happy. I don't know what's going on today. I think things, we've got so many new restaurants in Kansas City. I think that's changed a lot. I think we're sort of a last of a dying breed. It's really hard to find really great people that were as interested, I think, in food and as we used to be. I could be wrong.
You know, the culture in general seems to be more interested in food, and when you talk about all these new restaurants, that seems like, you know, out there just among the ordinary citizenry, a greater interest in food is probably inspiring that. But what do you think people are interested in, if not food, who are opening restaurants or working in kitchens?
What do you mean? I'm sorry.
Oh, well, you were just saying that people are less really interested in the food than they used to be.
Oh, not customers.
Oh.
I'm talking about trying to find really good people to work in our industry, to actually work as servers and cooks. I just feel like they're really hard to find now. I mean, I think it's maybe because there's so many restaurants, where a lot of restaurants here in town are having a lot of trouble finding some really good people that are wanting to, you know, work in the restaurant.
That's pretty fascinating and surprising.
I think so.
There, in restaurants, there's the front of the house, the part of the restaurant that the customer sees, and then there's the back of the house or the kitchen. And when you walk through the door that separates them, you're suddenly in a pretty different environment. Can you talk about the side of restaurants that diners don't typically see?
In the kitchen? Mm-hmm. Well, that's where all the action is, especially where I work. Our kitchen houses all of us. There's not like a separate place for our servers, for the dish people. We're all in one big room, so it's a crazy scene. And pretty chaotic but very organized as well. People don't see that. They might hear it out in the dining room. Things get loud back there, but. I'm not sure exactly what you're...
No, that's exactly it. Yeah. Do you think that the part of the appeal of a show like Cutthroat Kitchen is access to the kinds of characters who are in the part of... To that part of the dining experience that we don't usually see? I mean, I know Cutthroat Kitchen has its own spin with the whole, like, scary thing, especially in the Tournament of Terror, but that just that the appeal of reality food shows...
Yeah, it's a different show. It's completely, it doesn't matter if you're a really great chef or not. It's really interesting to see, too, because we do spend a lot of time with, I've been on the show a couple of times, and so you're sitting there with the other chefs that you're getting ready to compete with, and some of them are super serious, and the thing is it doesn't matter how great of a chef you are to be on this show. If you don't spend your money and sabotage your other opponents, then you're going down, and it's really funny to see some of the more arrogant, you know, chefs who think they're going to come in and take it all, you know, be voted out first and second because, you know, they got a little cocky and didn't spend their money wisely.
How did you end up at Cafe Sebastian?
The chef, Jennifer Maloney, my very, very dear friend, we've been friends for many, many years. I had been about in my 11th year of catering, and it was an exhausting job, catering, and I was a very busy caterer, and so I was ready to make a change, and we were just talking, and she said, why don't you come and be my sous chef? And I said, sounds great.
So how many years ago was this?
Almost 14, 15 years ago.
What is your favorite thing to make at Cafe Sebastian?
My favorite thing to make? I love to braise meats. I think that's one of my favorite things to do, and with really rich sauces. I do brunch on Sunday, so I like to come up with, you know, fun little brunch ideas. I like breakfast food a lot. I love to I don't eat breakfast, like I said earlier. I love to make breakfast food.
What do you think it is about braising that you enjoy?
The length of time it takes and the flavors you can develop.
Yeah. Jen Maloney, who you mentioned, who you work with, is a famously self-taught chef. And she's proud of that. She's got maybe a little bit of a toughness about her that probably comes from that. Has that attitude in any way shaped you as you've worked with her over these, what, 14 years, you just said?
Well, I'm much the same way, also self-taught. And so, yeah, I think that made us a really great team. You know, we each had our own strengths. And, you know, I think after a couple years of working together, we were able to really meld that into a great relationship.
Do you think that coming from similar backgrounds as in that way has sets your kitchen apart?
Yeah, I do think so. You know, we're a great team. We have, between the two of us, have, you know, great talents separately, and I think that, yeah, that's built what we've accomplished at Cafe Sebastian.
Another little known fact about you, you are also a musician, a bass player.
Yes, and a couple of different bands here in town. So that was a lot of fun, like one of the funnest things I've ever done in my life. I would like to try it again. So if anybody's out there and wants me to come and be their bass player.
If you had to find something that being a chef and playing the bass have in common, what would it be?
Oh, man. That is a really interesting question. I don't know. Bass playing and food. I don't know. I'm sorry.
No,
I'm at a loss.
I wonder about things like performance or just the role of the sous chef in the overall kitchen compared to the bass player in the band. I mean, I don't want to force this, but...
Oh, I kind of see where you're going there. Well, let's see. The bass player kind of sits back in a band, you know. It's kind of like, you know, you don't really notice the bass player as much as you might notice the lead singer, the lead guitarist, or even the drummer. And the sous chef is also one that's kind of back behind the executive chef, or, you know, if that's what you mean. I can kind of see what you're saying there.
I was just curious, you know. But maybe these are just two different parts of your existence.
Completely.
Well, when is the season finale of Cutthroat Kitchen?
It's just coming right up. It was supposed to be this Wednesday, but it's actually this Sunday, the 30th, October 30th, at 3:00 p.m., so in the afternoon. Hopefully the Chiefs game will be over and watch Cutthroat Kitchen.
Janet Ross with us from the Food Network's Cutthroat Kitchen and the Kemper Museum's Cafe Sebastian. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
After the break, another Kansas Cityan is getting noticed outside our town, a guy named Wuz Smith who's making streetwear. Stay tuned to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. Now let's meet Wuz Smith. He's a young clothing designer, like really young, as in 17, and has a streetwear label called Acid Luxury. That's Acid spelled A$ID, which stands for All the Money I Deserve. And his fashions, distressed jeans, parachute jackets, are hitting red carpets and drawing fans from all over the world. Hi, Wuz.
Hello, how you doing today?
Good, how are you?
I'm good.
How would you describe your style?
My style, I would say different, unique, you know? Like, it's easy to spot.
But what makes it that way? I mean, what would I spot that would be like, oh yeah, I know who made that?
As far as like specifically, like my pieces, I definitely say one of my parachute jackets. My parachute jackets have been something that people have been crazy for, so that's definitely something that you can, you know, notice from a mile away.
Describe your parachute jackets.
It's a green jacket made out of upholstery fabric, and it has Velcro straps on it. So like mucking a parachute, you know, a parachute is like supposed to keep you up, so a lot of details on it and zip-up jacket.
Tell me the story behind creating a label called All the Money I Deserve. How does that name or mission relate to you and what you were going for?
You know what? Honestly, I had to be around 13. And, you know, I decided one day that was what I wanted to do. And I created a name for myself and the brand, and then running with that way.
So that's kind of like a 13-year-old's fantasy in a way?
I don't know. You know, because I had been doing it for so long that I didn't look at it as a fantasy. You know, it was just kind of what I did, and I decided to put something behind it, you know.
And the business side of it, I mean, how did you cultivate a following? I mean, by the time you were doing that, you were a high school kid in Kansas City, not, you know, we're not in the middle of a fashion center like New York.
You know, I was actually in middle school. I was leaving the eighth grade. And I mean, as far as the business aspect goes, I wasn't coming into it as far as a businessman. You know, it was kind of me being an artist, and this is kind of what I did. And I looked at it that way instead of me looking at it as a business way, because it took me a long time to perform as a businessman and get into the business aspects out of it, you know.
Did your grandmother teach you how to sew? Did I understand that?
Yes, she did. My grandmother teaches me how to sew, and she still gives me pointers and help today. Big shout out to my grandmother. That's my biggest critic and my biggest supporter right now.
Tell me the story of your grandmother teaching you to sew. Can you take me there to your early lessons with you?
I forget what year it was, but I was so eager to make something because I got tired of just drawing on shirts and stuff like that. So I ended up hand sewing an entire sweater completely from just needle and thread. There was no machine. I didn't know how to use a machine at that time. So my grandmother told me, she was like, you know, well, why don't you learn how to do this? So we end up making a mesh T-shirt one day together. And from there on, this is when I kind of took it upon myself to teach myself new things. And
she's your toughest critic?
Yeah, like she'll tell me, like if I mess up on something, she's going to be like, oh, I mean, she'll tell me it's nice. But then again, like if something's wrong, she's going to say it's wrong because she want me to have the best product, you know, that there is.
Does your grandmother's opinion still matter a lot
to
you?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, that wouldn't change anything now. See what I'm saying? Because she still helps me a lot.
Tell me about your family and your life. Where do you live? What do you like to do?
I live in Kansas City. I'm from Kansas City. I really just like to create. I'm a creative person. I've been creating all my life. That's part of, you know, just who I am.
You just graduated from high school, right?
I just graduated. Yes, I did.
Where'd you go to school?
Frontier School of Excellence.
What was it like there? I mean, it's just right down the street from our studios.
Yeah, exactly. It was a pretty small school. You know, it made it easier to focus. And at first, I wasn't sure about going to a small school. You know, I didn't have a choice, but at the same time, it was just like, it ended up being the best thing for me because later on, creating a fan base and stuff like that, it was easier to focus.
What does the Frontier School, what is the focus of that school?
There's not a specific focus, but, you know, they target a lot in math and science base. So technology is a big aspect in that school.
Do you incorporate a lot of that technology into what you do now?
Honestly, I try not to. You know, I'm a really free creative person. So I just kind of let my creative flows control over what I do, basically.
Did school and friends and things like that change for you when you started making a name for yourself?
Yeah, it did. It did. I started getting, I would say, new friends. You know, it was crazy. Taking it all in at one time. And
what do you mean by, when you said new friends, you put that in air quotes?
Yeah. I mean, it was people who wouldn't normally approach me or befriend me, you know, that ended up wanting to be my friend and taking a liking to me. Yeah, it was weird. I wasn't sure about it at first.
How did you handle it?
I tried to choose my friends wisely.
What does that mean to you?
My friends?
Well, what does it mean to you to choose them wisely?
You know, just being around people who are positive-minded. And who also want to be great, if not what helped me be great at the same time.
So being great, it sounds like, is a part of it. What are your ambitions and goals? You've already achieved kind of a lot.
Yeah. I mean, of course I want to do more. You know, like I don't have set goals. I'm just kind of going with the flow right now because I think that's the best thing for me to do. But I just want to expand the brand, you know, raise awareness for myself.
Can you walk me through? You started making clothes and then at some point, things took off. What was the turning point? I mean, can you describe kind of how that happened?
You know, it was a process. Everything didn't blow up for me at one time. Things were happening gradually. You know, it was like crawling before walking. But I ended up sending a few products out to a few artists in different states. So I started gaining followers and a following in different states before actually reaching the following that I have now in Kansas City. So it kind of worked out backwards for me, you know.
Do you remember the first thing you sent off?
First thing I sent off was my grandmother actually made it. I drew it up and she sewed it for me because I couldn't sew like she can or could at the time. But it was a black and white paisley outfit with white AL written on the front of it and the pants.
Who did you send it to?
An artist named Maddie Baby, and he's from Chicago, Illinois.
Why did you want to send him that garment?
He was my favorite artist at the time. And it wasn't even me. Like, I didn't know what was to come with it because I had never seen an artist clothing before. But he was my favorite artist. So I was just like, you know, how cool would it be to get something that someone that I listen to or someone that inspires me on a daily basis in something that I created or something I designed?
Do you think that, I mean, a lot of people would hear that story and think that something like that takes some kind of guts, you know? And it seems like you're pretty nonchalant about sending, you know, making something and sending it to an artist you admire.
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, I kind of, I'm picky about it. You know, like you have to be someone that I see in a fashion sense. Because when people wear my clothing, I want them to wear it right. I want them to wear it with a meaning, you know, and an understanding of what they're wearing and not just putting it on.
What does it mean?
It's fashion. You know what I mean? It's style altogether.
I guess what I'm wondering is what, I mean, if this is sort of an expression of you, you've talked about being a really creative, free person and that you want people who wear the clothes that you make to also understand that they mean something and not just put them on. What does all of this mean to you?
I mean, it means everything to me. You know, the people see the vision. That's really what it's all about for me. It's for the vision. It's about the people see and understand my creativity.
Do you feel like that's something that needs, like, clothes to announce it or something? I mean, I'm curious what you feel like it is that people might not see about you without those clothes.
I don't know, because I try to incorporate my art. I was an artist before I was designing clothing. So I try to incorporate my art of it. I want people to see the art of it, the structure of it, the colors, you know, how I pick out certain things, the placement on the clothing.
In the community that you live in Kansas City, did you already have a reputation for those things? I mean, we're talking about you're so young when you started doing this, but you're talking about you were an artist even before that. Did people already see you as an artist in your community?
I wouldn't necessarily. Actually, yeah. You know, I mean, people know that I was drawing and I was painting stuff like that, like my family members, but I didn't have a big reputation for it. You know, like it wasn't something that people would see me and know about me.
What's your favorite thing you've ever worn?
Favorite thing I've ever worn?
Yeah.
That's hard. I couldn't think. I've accomplished a lot.
Do you like wearing clothes the same way you like making clothes, or are they just totally separate to you?
No, it's almost the same thing. I have a problem, actually. Sometimes I make stuff and I don't want to sell it. So I end up, like the jacket I have on now, I don't want to sell this. This is my jacket. I made it last night.
You're wearing, it's an orange and kind of blue and gray and navy blue.
Yeah, I call it Butterscotch English. It's a Butterscotch English fleece jacket.
And it's kind of plaid.
Yeah, it's definitely plaid.
You made that start to finish last night?
Yes, ma'am.
Man, I mean, so like at night, if you decide you want to wear something the next day, something
next day,
you don't
I'm
have.
I'm making it. I'm fine. I'm going to use whatever I have at the house and I'm going to make it happen.
Tell me about your necklace.
My necklace? This is the Jesus piece.
Are you religious?
Yes. I come from a very religious family.
Talk to me about that.
It helped a lot. You know what I mean? It built a lot of structure in my life. It guided me to see things I didn't see.
What else? How else would you describe what was, when you talk about bringing structure to your life, describe the rest of the picture that religion was fitting into. I mean, what was your life like?
You're
so young. I feel funny saying, what was your life like when you were younger?
I haven't even done yet. I had a pretty normal life. You know what I mean? Growing up into something, it's kind of like it's normal to you. So I didn't look at it in a different way or in a negative way, anything like that.
But so you live here in Kansas City.
Yes,
and
I do.
You just finished school. What have you been doing since you finished school?
I've just been expanding my brand, you know, working on the business side of things, on the design side, and getting more exposure.
Is there something that continues to drive you as you make clothes that you're trying to get to and haven't yet?
It's all about wanting more for yourself. You know what I mean? So, like, I kind of set personal goals, and then I look at those goals, and I figure out what I have to do to reach those goals, or even just when I'm making clothing, like, how can I be better, you know? How can I better the next piece?
What do you think pushed you to be so motivated? I mean, I know a lot of grown-ups who have never had the kind of motivation that you're describing right now.
I mean, like I said, I come from a very structural family, you know what I mean? Like, my dad was a big inspiration on me, you know, especially from the business side of things, because I didn't want to be a businessman. Like, that wasn't something that I wanted to be. I just wanted to create art. But then he was teaching me in the sense of that I have to, it's certain things that I'm take on, that I have to take on that I don't want to do, you know what I mean, to get to where I'm going.
What kinds of things don't you want to do?
Business classes. I'm not really, you know, I'm not really a, I would say I'm not the most scholastic person. You know, I mean, I don't like a lot of rules and things when I'm creating or when I'm doing things. But I mean, something that you have to do.
You talked about that your career making clothes has been a slow, gradual process, like crawling before walking.
Right.
But have there been like really special moments for you where you think like, I'm going to remember this moment. This was exciting. This was crazy.
Media attention, you know, media attention is something that really blows me away, because at the same time, it's like I'm looking at myself from the outside. You know what I mean? I'm seeing things happen for me. So the media attention was something that really just kind of blew me away, because for a long time, all I really wanted for people to recognize my pieces, you know, for somebody to understand the art.
Do you think that people do understand the art?
To a certain extent, but I still think there are certain aspects that people don't see as well as I do. And I don't think there's anything I can do to change that, because it's my vision. So nobody sees it as perfectly as I can or clearly.
What do you think people don't see?
You know, it's hard to explain being a visionist. It's hard to explain explaining what people don't see, because to a certain extent, you only know what they do see. You know,
have you ever heard something about a garment that you made that was just like, no, they don't get it? Or is it not like that?
No, it's not like that. I mean, the feedback is pretty simple. You know, it's normally I like that, or it could be a different color or something like that. You know, it's never really like people don't go in depth about it.
You started off sending your clothing to artists of other kinds, people mm-hmm. who create music, for example.
Right.
What do other kinds of art mean in your life? I mean, that you want to connect this clothing that you make to people who are creating other kinds of things.
I feel like it changes everything. You know what I mean? Because I'm an artist. So therefore, you can have to see certain stuff that you wouldn't normally see in the regular clothing. So I'm incorporating painting and drawing into the fashion world. You know, I'm bringing actual art into the fashion world.
How are you doing that?
By taking my art and infusing it in my pieces.
So you include like things that you've painted or drawn
in
your work?
Exactly. I might hand paint on the back of a jacket, or hand paint on jeans, or draw on a hat.
And has that been well received by people?
Yes. Some people, you know, honestly, some people won't even believe that I painted or I draw on some stuff that I do, because it normally looks like screen printing or something. People won't believe that I did it, but I mean, hey, I think there's a compliment at the same time. You know?
Are you hoping to stay in Kansas City?
I've done a little bit of traveling. I like Kansas City, but I think there's a lot more out there to see. You know what I mean? I'm not really. I mean, I'm young, so I don't know if I want to stay or go right now. I'm just kind of going with the flow of things and experiencing new places and new things.
What's your next step?
I don't even know.
You don't know?
However, I'm got it. I'm just going slowly. I'll be releasing a collection. My winter collection will be releasing next month. I don't have an actual date yet, but it'll be releasing.
Wes Smith, creator of the Acid Luxury clothing label. Thanks so much.
Yes.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and when KCUR's Central Standard returns, how a historic movie believed to be lost was recently found by a Kansas City guy. That's next after the break. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. Our next guest stumbled into film history recently when he came across the supposedly lost reels of a 1920s silent movie with a huge cast of Native American characters, a movie called Daughter of the Dawn. Brian Hearn, good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us what you knew about Daughter of the Dawn before any of this happened. Why and how did people talk about this movie?
Well, not many people had talked about it, and we were fortunate that in 1999, a high school history teacher in Oklahoma had written an article documenting the surviving materials from this film, which were basically three things. There was the original shooting script that miraculously had been deposited in the Library of Congress in 1920 after the film had been shot. And then there were about 35 production stills that had survived at this museum in southwestern Oklahoma near where the film was shot. And so because of those things, we knew that it had been made. And this author had also, Leo Kelly was his name, and he had done some other research and had found that it had premiered in Los Angeles in 1920. So we knew that it existed, but it was presumed lost at that time. And so in 2004, I got this call from... Yes.
What's the movie about?
The movie is basically a love quadrangle set among the Kiowa and Comanche nations in southwestern Oklahoma. Both of those tribes had been removed to reservations in the 1860s in that area. And so the movie really is kind of a love story.
When you talk about the groups, the Comanche and the Kiowa, were the representations thought to be respectful or stereotypical?
That's a great question. It's worth noting that it was made by a white man. It was written and directed by a guy named Norbert Miles for essentially a white entertainment audience. But the representation was remarkable that it was essentially not trafficking in stereotypes of the time that Hollywood has kind of perpetuated well into the 21st century. And it really treated Native American people as normal people with loves and desires and strengths and weaknesses like everyone else.
What is the movie's connection to Kansas City?
I have not been able to prove this yet, but I believe that it did screen here in a roadshow at some point in the early, either 1920 or 21. And that's one of the areas of research that still needs to be done, is sort of tracing the exhibition history. I did fish up a... advertisement that it had screened in Joplin, Missouri in October of 1920. And you know, it was rather sensational, hyperbolic language, you know, the Daughter of Dawn, based on historical facts, a sensational story of the Kiowa and Comanche Indian tribes in the early days of Oklahoma, wonderful heart and love interest. So, and it was even advertising that six genuine Kiowa Indians who actually played in the film will appear before the movie.
Would it have been unusual, just looking at film history, for, I mean, now there's so much controversy over who plays underrepresented kinds of characters. So, like, were they actual Native Americans playing the Native American characters? And it sounds like, in this case, they were. Was that in any way ahead of its time, or was that... Typical.
Absolutely. No, it was not typical. And it was incredible that that occurred. And it really was just how this film was developed. It was an independent production. The writer-director had worked in Hollywood in silent films and had been brought into this project by a guy named Richard Banks, who had lived among Native American people for 25 years. And he put this project together and wanted to shoot it in southwestern Oklahoma. And he had a long relationship with the Kiowa and Comanche people, which is why he essentially had access to their culture. And the director, Norbert Miles, wrote an unpublished account of his, it was called My Adventure Among the Oklahoma Indians, after the production, and talked about how, you know, his friends in Hollywood were teasing him about being scalped, you know, watch out. But what he realizes is that the actors that he worked with, many of whom were acting for the first time, spoke better English than his friends in Hollywood. And so, but yes, he cast, it was a huge cast, almost 300 actors, but really four main actors that were all Kiowa or Comanche. And two of them notably were the children of Quanah Parker, the famous chief of the Comanche Nation.
So back to how you come into all of this, why did people think the film was lost?
Well, there were no surviving prints as of you know, the year 2000. We no one had ever seen this film in 80 years, and that's sort of where the story gets kind of amazing. Is that in 2004, I was the film curator at the Oklahoma City Museum of Art, And I received a call one day from a private detective in North Carolina who claimed to have the film.
Why is he calling you? I mean, also, why are private detectives scrounging up film scholarship? That's not what I imagine them doing.
No, it's very unlikely. Well, basically, this guy had been paid for his services by a gentleman whose ancestor had owned a silent movie theater. And this is often how these things survive, is that they end up in some forgotten room in an old theater. Anyway, this guy had been paid with this film, and he had reached out to me because we exhibited film on film still, which was getting rarer as digital was taking over. And so we were committed to film preservation. We'd done a number of silent film screenings, and he somehow tracked me down and thought, well, this would be a good place to kind of shop the film. And he wanted $35,000 for the movie, which, you know, is not nothing, especially to a nonprofit art museum. So we didn't have a budget for that.
When you get this call, I mean, I imagine that curators of all kinds get calls from people who claim they have something of great monumental value. I mean, a lot of people might have just kind of dismissed a call like that. Did something tell you that this was legit?
Well, I was highly skeptical, of course, but the fact that he knew the name of that film, which had only been written about in this one article, I mean, essentially it had been forgotten. So the fact that he knew about that was just incredible to me. So I was intrigued. I wanted to know more. I wanted to see some evidence, of course. And I had reached out to some colleagues at the Oklahoma Historical Society. They were the biggest film repository at that time in our state. And they were like, they had the same response I did, which was like, nuh-uh, you know, like, no way. And so essentially we reached out to this guy again and said, you know, we need some proof. And it was not unlike some kind of ransom where, you know, they cut off a pinky and send it to you to prove that they have this person. But
what was the film version?
What do you mean?
What was the film version of that scenario?
Well, he clipped off several frames of the film and mailed it to us.
For real?
Yes. And it was...
That doesn't damage the film?
Well, it was not ideal. especially because at that time, the nitrate film stock, which is very flammable, very fragile, and it was remarkable that it survived, you know, disintegration over time. But we could tell from those few frames, he had some intertitles in there. And we're like, wow, you know, he has the film.
Why does it matter? I mean, why does having this film matter?
It's a great question. I mean, for one thing, it's our shared cultural heritage. I mean, on many counts, both as a motion picture, as an entertainment object, but more importantly, this film documents the material culture of the Kiowa and Comanche nations in a way that had never been depicted. If you think about Hollywood, quote unquote, Indians, you know, they were played by Hollywood actors, typically the costumes.
And Hollywood cast costumes, yeah.
Indeed, yeah, from Western Costume, you know, the great costume house there. And they were fake, you know, top to bottom. And so this really was a completely different representation. And
what was different about the costumes? I mean, that they're real, obviously, but what specifically did you see that you wouldn't have seen in the typical?
Well, you can tell the garments are authentic. I mean, the way that they're worn, the buckskin dresses, the war bonnets. I mean, this type of material is remarkable in its, you know, authenticity. And you can see that in the film. I mean, it's beautifully photographed. Another important component of the film were teepees that appear in the film. And one of them in particular that Daughter of Dawn, the character of Daughter of Dawn, lives in, when the film was acquired by the Oklahoma Historical Society and we were looking at it for the very first time, one of the Native American curators, he recognized that very teepee was in their collection already. It had been gifted from the Cheyenne Nation to the Kiowa tribe in the 1840s. And periodically, teepees are renewed with ceremonial kind of painting and care. And And so they had this in their collection, the very same teepee that was in the film that Daughter of Dawn lives in. And so these sort of elements were starting to fall into place, which was incredible.
So you receive the couple frames that mm-hmm. Had been clipped off to prove the authenticity of this film. Mm-hmm. When you got the whole thing, other than a couple of frames having been clipped off, what kind of shape was it in?
I mean, for its age and for the fragility of the medium, it was an incredible shape. I mean, the worst thing was that the intertitles had been cut off. Many of them had been cut off, which was not unusual because as films would be built up onto one reel and taken apart again, they would lose frames.
So in silent film, that would be like the frame that tells you what's about to happen.
Correct. Yeah. The text, the dialogue would appear in an intertitle between the visual frames. And so so initially when the film came in, it was 5 reels, and we knew it to be a 6 reel film. So there was some mystery there that had to be solved. But ultimately, when the intertitles were restored back in, and that was also possible because the script had survived, it was easy to recreate, that it added up to a 6 reel film again.
What was it like to sit and watch this movie?
I mean, I get chills every time I see it. I mean, you know, we kind of world premiered it with a new musical score that had been commissioned by the Oklahoma Historical Society that was composed by a Comanche composer. And it's so beautiful. It's a beautifully shot film. It's technically very advanced for its time, even though it was essentially a one-man camera person who shot it. But it's beautiful looking. The area where it's shot is really extraordinary, in the Wichita Wildlife Refuge in southwestern Oklahoma. So, I mean, it's beautiful.
When you talked about there were, 300 people who were in this movie,
mm-hmm.
were you able to connect any living people with, like, ancestors or relatives who had appeared in the movie? I mean, did you bring this back to the communities it came from?
Yes. My colleagues at the Oklahoma Historical Society were very wise to take this to the Kiowa and Comanche nations and have community screenings down there. And that occurred in this process of restoration. And that was such a powerful experience, because think about, you know, many of these people seeing this are seeing their ancestors on screen for the first time, and seeing them in their authentic dress, and in some cases seeing their dances on screen. And it was very emotional, and a lot of wonderful stories emerged from those screenings.
For you, I mean, I'm guessing that you are not Native American yourself.
Correct.
Has this experience changed how you view your own story? I mean, it's such a crazy thing to have happen to you. Are you like a changed man because this happened?
I mean, this is the stuff you dream about as someone that cares about film preservation or silent film. It's a miracle that this thing survived. And I grew up in Oklahoma, so I've always kind of been around Native American culture and people, and really appreciate it. So I definitely, this gave me a depth of appreciation for something like this that I am grateful for, and was very passionate about, you know, seeing this through, making sure it was preserved so that, you know, future generations can see this. And that's going to happen because it was named to the National Film Registry in 2013.
In 1920, I mean, what you just said about it being a miracle, I think about that at that time, film wouldn't have been so taken for granted, just that you can put living, walking human beings up on a screen in front of you that was still reasonably new. I mean, do you feel like there's a little bit of something come back from the dead, like the animation of something?
Absolutely. I mean, there was something kind of guiding this movie back to the big screen, or the small screen, or any screen. It's on Netflix now, so I hope people will check it out.
Brian Hearn, thanks for telling us the story of the once lost film, Daughter of the Dawn, that's now been found thanks to, weirdly, a private detective who called your office one day Changing How Film History is Written. You can listen back to all three of the Kansas City stories on today's show online later today. We'll have them packaged up and ready to go at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, tune in for how art and artists shape our city within the walls of museums and out in neighborhoods. Tomorrow at 10. In the meantime, talk to us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope, with help from interns Raven Brooks and Aaron Pelish. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.